when I look over the rest of the schedule, I realize that I should have left a week or two to do some other things that we're going to miss doing. But rather than dwell on what we're going to miss, let's just do what we can get done. This day, I have to apologize to begin with because I'm giving you two lessons crammed into one. It's a shame that we're going to deal with religion in Great Britain in the 19th century. We should spend a week in England and a week in Scotland and if I had enough sense, a week in Wales and Northern Ireland. But anyway, all we can do is a real survey. So that's what we're going to do this morning, looking at the condition of the church and certain things about it in 19th century Great Britain. England. When you think of England, you obviously have to think of the Church of England. The Church of England is the established religion of the land. The monarch is the head of the church and committed to be the defender of the faith, even though the upcoming monarch says he wants to be defender of faiths. But at the moment, the queen is head of the church. The Church of England, when you think about the Church of England, it's really three churches in one. The first way I would describe it is the broad church. By the broad church, another word that you can use is latitudinarianism. In the broad church, the doctrine is not deep. The arms are very wide. And you don't have to believe a lot of anything. You just have to be a nice person. Bishop Ryle, writing in the beginning of the middle of the 19th century, talking about the broad church and asking the question how broad it was, he said that he would declare the church as a Noah's Ark in which every kind of faith and creed would dwell undisturbed. And the only terms of communion is a willingness to come inside and let your neighbor alone. Unfortunately, this is a description of most of the mainline church today. Certainly a very large element in the Church of England, and that's applicable to the Episcopal Church here in the United States, which we'll get to in a minute. Bishop Ryle says the church is not in good condition. And when you look at the broad part of the church, it wasn't in good condition. One of the best things going for it, though, the 39 articles and the Book of Common Prayer. Because within the Book of Common Prayer is the gospel. William Wilberforce said, we've lost the gospel out of our pulpits, but we still have it in our Book of Prayer. If you read the Book of Common Prayer, you will understand that Jesus Christ is the only hope for man, the substitute for sinners, the incarnate Son of God. That's encompassed in the Book of Common Prayer. So that's a good thing. But within the broad church and in the Church of England, you also have something called the evangelical movement. Some people have called the evangelical movement the low church. The evangelical movement within the Church of England makes no great claims on polity, on priesthood, on sacraments, but it looks to the gospel as its basis for association. The evangelical movement within the Church of England, we could say in one sense, it began as an evangelical body in the time of the Reformation with the Puritan separatists, yes. But you really look for the beginning of the evangelical movement in the Church of England to the time of the evangelical revival under Whitfield and Wesley in the 1730s, 40s, and 50s. This infused into the Church of England a real passionate group of people, passionate for Christ, passionate for what makes up an evangelical. The fact that the Bible is the inerrant Word of God, Christ alone is the way to the Father, and the gospel makes a difference in someone's life. It changes you. The premises of being an evangelical is this. So there was a great movement within the Church of England following the evangelical revival. But this movement resulted in the formation of the Methodist Church. So the Methodist Church left the Church of England. And when they left the Church of England, a large percentage of evangelicals left the Church of England also. So at the beginning of the 18th century, the 19th century, the Church of England was much weaker because the more evangelicals had left. Not all evangelicals had left, but many had. the evangelicals in the late 18th and 19th century, you could look at them and we could speak of a couple of men. This man here, I think many would recognize. This is our dear John Newton. Most of you know about Newton, so we won't spend much time there. Obviously, the converted slave trader. Obviously, the author of Amazing Grace and other many other great hymns. Pastor Stu says that he thinks the letters of Newton are the best things from the heritage of Newton that you could have today. Read the letters of Newton. They're sweet and they're precious. John Newton was the very best in the evangelical wing of the Church of England. Another gentleman in the Church of England that was an evangelical was Thomas Scott. I had a little affinity for him. Maybe it's the name. I don't know. He was an Anglican clergyman, but he functioned as a clergyman as an unconverted man. Didn't have a lot of problem with it, because there were other unconverted men that were clergy in the Church of England too. But as he was functioning, he began to observe things that were happening around him. He began to look at John Newton. I don't have this quote, I don't believe, but Thomas Scott said something. No, I didn't bring the quote. He said something to the effect that as he looked around and saw the evangelical men like Newton and saw how they lived holy and changed lives, he began to consider what they were preaching and what they were teaching. He also read some good books. And as he read these books, he was brought to understand that he was not converted. Now, he fought against truth. He said, "The Bible would teach predestination, election, and final perseverance in spite of my twisting and expounding it to try to make it teach something else." He didn't want it to teach these things, but it taught these things. He was converted. He wrote several books. One's called The Force of Truth, which has been republished by Banner. This is his personal testimony. Another is his commentary on the Bible. The first time I found a copy of Scott's commentary, it was in an antique, a junk store before it was republished. And it was helpful. William Carey, our Baptist forefather, said, "If there be anything of the work of God in my soul, I owe much of it to his, Scott's, preaching when I first set out in the way of the Lord." Scott became a warm-hearted evangelical commentator and preacher. When you consider that Thomas Scott and John Newton could exist within the framework of the same church that people who probably virtually denied Christ, certainly were dead and had no life in them. That's a paradoxical thing. It's hard for us. It's very hard for me. It's very difficult to understand how these men labored within the same structure as men who were unbelievers. But they did. There were other evangelical leaders in the Church of England. This gentleman is the name Charles Simeon. Charles Simeon pastored, this is a modern day picture, of Holy Trinity Church in Cambridge. He was the pastor of Holy Trinity for 54 years. Holy Trinity had a great heritage. It had been pastored by Richard Sipps. It had been pastored by Thomas Goodwin. So the church knew good preaching. This obviously was a university city. He was at Cambridge. John Piper brought a biographical lecture on Simeon at the pastor's conference, I think in 2001 or two. You can download it for free, as you can everything from Desiring God. A great lecture. It would warm your heart to listen to it. Charles Simeon ministered to students, obviously, being there in Cambridge. One of the students that he ministered to was named Henry Martin. Some of the pastors heard Pastor Hughes give a biographical sketch of Henry Martin just 2 weeks ago. Henry Martin, a young man who went as a missionary to India and Persia. Henry Martin came out of this time. The sermons of Simeon were published in a book called Horae Homileticae, 21 volumes, 2,536 sermons. Mr. Spurgeon referred to this and said, some people have said Simeon sermons were dry bones. He said, go looking for truth with the Spirit of God, and you will find that these bones are life, life, life. Someone else has said that I was listening to a lecture to seminary students. He said, I'd suggest you young men, when you have your text for the Lord's Day and your sermon is prepared, go read Simeon, see what he thinks about it. And if he disagrees with you, maybe you ought to change. He said, don't preach Simeon, because if you followed his style, it would die today. But the truth that's in it is very warm, applicable, useful truth. Pastor Simeon was a member of something called the Clapham Sect. The Clapham Sect receives its name because they met at a church in Clapham, pastored by John Venn, V-E-N-N, which was a suburb or a part of London. The Clapham Sect, in its simplest definition, was a group of lay Christians putting the evangelical life into practice. Wasn't the preachers. Now, the preachers met with them some, but these were Christian businessmen, teachers, Christians who wanted to put the truth of the gospel. What does the gospel do in changing our lives? What does the gospel do to impact culture? That's a question that should be on the minds of the church today. What do we do to carry the gospel out? Do we carry it out only by preaching on the street corners? Or do we carry it out by doing good works? Do we go and doing our good works and attempt to adjust the morals of the society around us? Should we fight for moral issues? That was things that drove these men who were members of the Clapham Sect. The Clapham group, one of the most famous members is this gentleman. You may not recognize his picture because this is a young picture of him, but this is William Wilberforce. I'm sure you'd recognize the older picture. William Wilberforce was a man of means, came from high society. At age 21, he was admitted to a member of parliament. Wilberforce had a vision. He had a vision to do some great things for the Lord. God Almighty has put before me two great objects: the abolition of the slave trade and the reformation of the manners or conduct of England. He wanted to see the horrible institution of the slave trade ended. This was not an easy thing to do. He carried his petitions to Parliament. He was rejected many, many times. He was encouraged to continue. Early on, John Wesley, at the end of his life, wrote him a letter. He said to Mr. Wilberforce, "Dear sir, unless God has raised you up for this very thing, you will be worn out by the opposition of men and devils. But if God be for you, who can be against you? Are all of them together stronger than God?" He concludes, "Stronger than God, oh, be not weary of well-doing. In the name of God, go, and in the power of his might." He concludes by saying that God, he who has guided you from your youth, may continue to strengthen you in this and all things, is the prayer, dear sir, of your affectionate servant, John Wesley. Wilberforce needed this encouragement from a leader such as Wesley, because how many times was he defeated in Parliament? 11 times or 17 times or something like that. I don't remember. How many have seen the movie Amazing Grace? Oh, a goodly number. I have it on DVD and I have not watched it yet. And I didn't have time to watch it last night, so I wouldn't have to admit that I still hadn't seen it. But we do have it. If anybody hadn't seen it and wants to see it, just call me. Come over to my house. We'll watch it together. He did see that slavery was abolished as a practice in 1807. And at the end of his life, he was able to see all the slaves in the British Empire emancipated. So by the end of his days, he saw this object of his work completed: the abolition of slavery, the emancipation of the slaves. But what about his other passion? What did he mean by talking about the manners? What about manners? Now, he wasn't talking about be kind and nice and sweet and tolerant. Say yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. He was talking about the very way that you lived. He wrote a book called A Practical View of the Prevailing Religious System of Professed Christians and the Higher and Middle Classes in This Country Contrasted with Real Christianity. Needless to say, Amazon wouldn't have liked the title. But it was a powerful book. He wrote it directed to the middle and higher classes of people. He was from a higher class. He realized what they thought about Christianity. They thought it was placid. They had all been baptized. They were all members of the Church of England. But they didn't see anything passionate, anything to change really the way they lived. But in this book, which some have called A Practical View, others have called Real Christianity, I think Real Christianity is the best thing to call it, had a great effect on the people. And evidence of the effect was even in this country. William Meade, who was later bishop of the Episcopal Church in Virginia, says he remembers as his youth, and in his youth, his parents reading Real Christianity. And as they read it, it changed their life. They were converted and changed people. The whole diocese of Virginia for the Episcopal Church moved from a broad latitudinarian diocese to an evangelical diocese by the time Wilberforce was dead. The book was powerful in laying out the claims of Christ to the middle and the higher classes that resulting in a change of behavior. Other evangelicals in the Church of England actually developed what we could call the Evangelical Party. I think many of you will recognize that dear gentleman, J.C. Ryle, Bishop of Liverpool. Actually, I have found a photograph of Bishop Ryle, and he looks better in the drawing, so we used the drawing rather than the photograph this time. You may remember a couple of years back when Pastor Hughes came up and gave us that biographical sketch of J.C. Ryle. If you don't remember it, you can download it for free at our site, or you can request the CD for $1, which is virtually free. Listen to it. It'll warm your heart. Pastor Hughes has a great ability of taking biographical information and giving it to you in a heartwarming way. If I train, maybe someday I can do that. I don't know. Maybe when I get older, I can learn how to do something sweet like that rather than controversial. Bishop Ryle, evangelical leader of the party. This gentleman, not a great picture, Hanley G.C. Moule. He was Bishop of Durham, and he was a leader in the Keswick movement in England, another man in the evangelical movement. Bishop of Durham. Does anyone know who the Bishop of Durham is today in the Church of England? Come on, you preacher boys. You ought to know who the Bishop of Durham is. Tom Wright, Bishop N.T. Wright, the leading evangelical spokesman for the doctrine of the resurrection of Christ, alive today, is Bishop Wright. If he had stayed with Christ in the resurrection and ignored Paul, we would be better off, because he's also a man who brought in the new perspective on Paul. But I refused to throw him out of the family because he was wrong on Paul, because he was so right on Christ. And if you want to read about the resurrection and the evidences for it and how to speak about it today, you can do no better than Bishop N.T. Wright. Anyway, Tom Wright's the bishop of that. Evangelical Party. Today, there's still an evangelical party in the Church of England, identified by men such as John R.W. Stott, who's just retired, by Dr. J.I. Packer, who also has just retired. It was Packer's little interview that I was tacked on to the end, but it's not there. These men, warm evangelical men, they remained in the Church of England when other good men called them to leave. 1965, there was a difference that arose between Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones and these men, because Dr. Lloyd-Jones literally called them to separate from the Church of England, and they rejected this. The Banner of Truth issue, of the commemorative issue of Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones from a couple of years ago, Ian Murray reviews this. This is just fact. It's not scuttle. These men remained and were faithful in the Church of England. It's interesting that today, well, I'll mention it in a minute, today Dr. Packer is saying it's time to leave because of what's going on in the Church of England. Bishop Ryle said there's two great problems in the Church of England. The broad church, we've talked about the fact of it being like a Noah's Ark. One person has said it took in everybody and everything without making any kind of doctrinal statement or requirement. Bishop Ryle also says that there were efforts in the Church of England to unprotestantize it. Well, how would you unprotestantize a church? Well, you would reject what the church was holding that came from the Reformation. There was one man in this movement who said that he hated the Reformation. How do you have a Church of England without the Reformation? Bishop Ryle said the efforts were to unprotestantize it. This resulted in the formation and identification of something called Anglo-Catholicism, which is the high church. So now we have the broad church, the low church, and the high church. The high church is next door to Catholicism. Some of the leaders of the high church, well, another thing it could be called is the Oxford movement, because it seemed to be based in Oxford, where the evangelicals were based in Cambridge. Another reference to the high church, they're called Tractarians because they wrote numerous tracts, readable tracts, intended to influence the people. John Henry Newman was one of their primary leaders. Finally, in 1888, he wrote something called Apologia Pro Vita Sua, which was his explanation of how he eventually leaves the Church of England, joins the Church of Rome, and they make him a bishop. In fact, they make him a cardinal. Cardinal Newman was their poster child, as it were, to saying to the rest of the church, you should leave and become like us. I think the student youth organizations on many university campuses today are called Newman Societies. Can someone confirm that? You have the Asbury group, you have the Newman group. I went to college, I was a non-denominational, they didn't have a group for us. So I went to the Episcopal Church in Lewisburg because you got to kneel when you prayed, and I could stay awake if I got to go down and come back up. But if I sat in the Baptist church, we was gone. Anyway, sidelight. Cardinal Newman, Newman Society, the leader of Anglo-Catholicism. The Church of England doesn't divide. It allows all of these movements to exist. Again, hard for me to understand. I've put down here a question. How about the Church of England today? How about the Anglican Church today? Well, it's going to divide. And it's a good thing. In my class before the last group, I talked a whole lot more about this. But because of things such as the ordination of Gene Robinson as the Bishop of New Hampshire, a openly gay man in a ongoing relationship, not a celibate homosexual, but an active homosexual. The church, the Episcopal Church in the United States, follows up this despicable action 2 years later by electing the Right Reverend Catherine Jeffers Shakuri as the presiding bishop of the whole Episcopal Church. So rather than having any evidence of repentance of their sins for electing Robinson, they elect this lady, who in an interview in the Boston Globe said that she could not say that Jesus was the only way to God. There were multiple and many ways that people of faith take. Now, that is the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church. Good churches are leaving the Episcopal Church USA. Whole dioceses, like the diocese in Pittsburgh, There's a diocese in Orange County, Southern California. The whole diocese has voted to remove themselves. This past issue of World Magazine had an article on a Episcopal church in Charlotte that a number of people left. They left their property and they're meeting in a school right now. Many of the churches have brought their property with them. Big churches like Falls Church and Turek Church outside of D.C. The churches that pulled out first looked to bishops outside of the United States, first to Bishop Akinola in Nigeria. There's another dear bishop in Nigeria. In fact, the church in Nigeria is evangelical and strong, where the church in America is cancerous. Now they have recognized Martin Menz out of Pittsburgh as bishop, and they're going to have a meeting this summer. And they're hoping that there will be a province, a new province of the Church of England. The Anglican Church is a new Episcopal church encompassing these evangelical Episcopals that have left. Someone asked Dr. Packer, there's all of a 14-second interview with him on YouTube if you want to see his answer, on should the church vote to come out. He says, yes. And here's someone who's 80-some years old who says now it is time. And the reason why, the Anglican Church, the Episcopal Church in the U.S. and certainly in Canada, has ceased to be Christian. If you deny the inerrancy of Scripture, if you deny the exclusivity that Christ is the only way to the Father, then you are not Christian. Their dear Episcopal brethren who have left, they're wanting to hold to basic evangelical doctrine, and if you have occasion to know any of them, encourage them in their way. It's not going to be an easy thing to bring the churches together because some of the evangelical churches who have left still hold to the right of ordination of women, and others do not. How they're going to be able to come together, I don't know, but I hope that they're successful, because this does give a gospel witness. Someone in here, not in here, the one in the church shared with me the other night of being in a hospital and said, many years ago, and seeing the Episcopal priest show up, you know, with his backward collar and all, and he said he was getting the last drags out of his cigarette outside the door, you know, and threw it away before he came in. And he said, I was thinking to myself, what is this? And he says, he goes behind the curtain where this patient was, and he said, he proceeds to give the gospel to that person in that bed. And the most real, passionate, applicable way, and our dear member here was saying to me, I was standing on the other side of that curtain, chagrined that the man didn't know how to put on his collar and was smoking his cigarette outside the door. But he said he was passionately applying the gospel to that person. Now, he could have been reading out of the prayer book and been passionately applying the gospel to that person, because it's in the prayer book. But the lesson is, everybody that doesn't know how to put on a collar is not necessarily a bad person. We better leave it at that. Go back to your notes, David. What else do we find in the Church of England? They're nonconformist. The word nonconformist means anybody that doesn't conform to the Episcopal Church order and adhere to the 39 articles in the Book of Common Prayer. If you're anything but in the Church of England, you're a nonconformist. Different groups of nonconformists. There were heirs of the Puritans who were nonconformists. There were Presbyterians. Unfortunately, by the beginning of the 18th, by the middle of the 18th century, the Presbyterians had virtually disappeared. The Presbyterians in England was the most liberal Protestant group, and they left the faith. You had Congregationalists. You had some Baptists. We'll get to the Baptists later. I think if anyone in here doesn't recognize this picture, then they're going to re-examine your membership, because obviously everyone knows that this is Charles Haddon Spurgeon. When we do Baptist history next year, there may be an opportunity for certain ones to do biographies. I'm not sure about that. But I'm not giving up Spurgeon. I've never had the opportunity to teach Spurgeon to an adult group before, so I'm keeping Spurgeon. Y'all guys can have the rest of them. Spurgeon, following in the line of Latimer and Whitfield, was a great preacher. It's hard for us to imagine the clamor that it was for the sermons of Charles Haddon Spurgeon. It's hard for us to imagine the thousands of people that made their way to Metropolitan Tabernacle to hear him, or the thousands who heard him during the week, because he would leave out on Monday carrying his sermon, and he would preach for 3 or 4 days sometimes in the small villages or towns outside of England. Now, he didn't preach new stuff. He preached what he had already preached, because he said any message God gives you that's worth preaching once is worth preaching at least 8 or 10 times. And it's they didn't have the internet, so people hadn't read it. But Spurgeon preached. He was a preacher. He was a passionate preacher. Towards the end of his life, they were transcribing his sermons. They would send them by telegraph to New York. And on Monday, maybe Tuesday, I'm not sure about this, but virtually the next day, the New York Times would run Spurgeon's Sunday sermon. Can you get your pea brain around that? That even in the early part of the 20th century, I think it continued to about 1906 or something like that. There was like 8 or 9 or 12 years worth of sermons that had not been published, and they kept publishing. He died in 1892, but for about another 12 years, they published his weekly sermon in the New York Times. Spurgeon was a great preacher. But not only was he a great preacher, he was a doctrinal preacher. In the Forgotten Spurgeon, Ian Murray's monumental little book, he brings us back to what Spurgeon was that everybody wants to ignore. Spurgeon, in his own words, was an Augustinian. He was a Calvinist. He was a Paulinist. He preached the gospel unashamedly. It was the Forgotten Spurgeon that the Lord used in the summer of 1969 to introduce me to the doctrines of grace. And I couldn't find my copy. I got newer copies, but I don't know how many people have been affected by that book, because it is so full of warm, warm, warm truth. I think I had a quote here from Spurgeon. I do, if I can find it. Spurgeon, talking about being a doctrinal preacher and a powerful preacher, Spurgeon was writing in some of his own words. He says, "We want John Knox back again. Do not talk to me of mild and gentle men, of soft manners and squeamish words. We want the fiery Knox, and even though his vehemence should ding our pulpits into blads, it were well if he did but rouse our hearts to action." Spurgeon was a powerful preacher who wanted the church to act. Spurgeon recognized the problems that the church was going to have. He recognized the problems his own denomination, which was the Baptist Union, had. And it came up, and we know that. It's the downgrade controversy. The downgrade controversy was, in essence, he saw the liberal theology that was coming into the Baptist Union, and he opposed it. I think I have a quote from him. He says, "We used to debate upon particular and general redemption, but now men question whether there is any redemption at all worthy of the name." That's sad. That's sad. J.I. Packer says, if you talked about the downgrade controversy then, that what the church is facing today is not a downgrade, but a nosedive. And I think Dr. Packer was right. The church has nosedived, and the organized church in many places has left the gospel and left Christianity. Dr. Calhoun said that the best preacher to preach Reformed doctrine that the common man could understand it was C.H. Spurgeon. You listen to Dr. Calhoun's older lectures on Spurgeon, And you can hear that he really, 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 really wished that Spurgeon was a Presbyterian, because he loves everything about Spurgeon except that one little thing that makes him Baptist. Of course, we love all of that and that one little thing that makes him Baptist. We got us one here, Dr. Calhoun. We're going to keep him. But Spurgeon is the best preacher of Reformed doctrine so that the common man could understand it. Question: if the common man, the average person walking in off the street, cannot understand the gospel every Sunday that comes from that pulpit, are you really preaching the gospel? Are you really preaching the gospel if you use store-bought words and phrases that the common man can't understand? We may have a congregation of educated people. There may be a congregation of educated people, but the man walking in off the street needs to be able to understand the gospel every time someone stands behind that pulpit. I believe they can understand it here. I can answer the question for that, so don't think I'm questioning. But the gospel must be understood, as Dr. Calhoun says, by the common man. Well, moving from some of these men who are outside of the Church of England, this is our summation of England. We now have 17 minutes to go to the dear land of Scotland. How in the world do you do the Presbyterian Church in 17 minutes? Hang on, we're going to take a chance. This painting of John Lorimer, called The Ordination of Elders in a Scottish Kirk, hangs in the National Gallery in Edinburgh today. If there's one thing that identifies Scotland, it's the Church of Scotland. If there's anything that identifies the Church of Scotland, it's the fact that it's a Presbyterian church. A Presbyterian church has elders. So you see probably the teaching elder there with his hands raised in ordination service of the ruling elders that are around the table pledging themselves for the gospel work. Background in Scotland. We know that there was a settlement in 1690. This settlement established the Church of Scotland as a Presbyterian church. But this settlement in 1690 really was the culmination of 130 tumultuous years. The first settlement of the Church of Scotland was in 1560, and it was led by John Knox and his compadres there, and Presbyterianism was established in Scotland. 1603, I think I put that up, James the Sixth of Scotland becomes James the First of England. So Scotland and England are joined by one king. James the First, James the Sixth, left his Presbyterian moorings and adopted episcopacy, believing that without a bishop you do not have a strong king. Therefore it thrust the church in Scotland into great conflict. This conflict was heightened in 1660 with the restoration of the Stuarts. Charles II, James's son, comes to the throne in England and Scotland. It begins the time that can be referred to as the killing time in Scotland, the time of our covenanter forefathers, who said that they would not hold to episcopacy. They held to the solemn league and covenant that claimed Christ alone as being the king. Well, in 1690, with the restoration, the glorious revolution of William of Orange, you had one king again over England and Scotland, a Protestant king, and he called for this great settlement. And you would have two churches. You have the Anglican Church, obviously, in England. You have the Presbyterian Church in Scotland. So from 1690 on, you have officially the Church of Scotland, and it's Presbyterian. It's interesting. If the monarch, who is the defender of the faith, is in England, the monarch is a member of the Church of Scotland, England. But if the monarch goes to Balmoral, the summer castle, when the monarch crosses the boundary, the monarch then becomes Presbyterian. Queen Victoria would go to the little Kirk of Crivey, it was called, and worship there at Balmoral. The clerk of the Kirk being the church, the clerk of the Kirk would make an entry at communion time of people who took communion. And one entry, he says, shepherds, 12. Servants, 12. Queen, 1. Noting that the queen was taking communion in that kirk, because Presbyterianism is the Church of Scotland. Well, what are there other groups in Scotland besides the Presbyterians? Obviously, they are outside groups. You have Scottish Episcopalians. There was an Episcopal church from 1660 to 1690. We talked about some good men that were in it, like Philip Doddridge. But obviously, with the restoration of William and Mary and the establishment of the Presbyterian Church, the Presbyterians didn't have a very high view of the Episcopalians who were in Scotland. And actually, from the next 50, 70 years, the Episcopalians were noted to be supporting the Jacobite movement, which tried to bring the king across the water, James II, back to the Scottish throne. It's intrigue. It doesn't matter. Another group that would not go into the Church of England were the Covenanters. Now, the Covenanters, we certainly respect where they came from, but the Covenanters said that Church of Scotland wasn't Presbyterian enough. Because in the settlement of 1690, the Church of Scotland did not reaffirm the Solemn League and Covenant. And so the Covenanters said, we're not going to have a part of that church. So while the Church of Scotland was the official church, you had the Episcopalians, you had the Covenanters worshiping alone. They worshipped first in something called societies. And finally, I think I put it down, in 1743, they formed the Reformed Presbyterian Church Associate. This is the Associate ARP Church that you find in North America today. It's still a small group in Scotland and Northern Ireland and in North America. It's practicing exclusive solemnity. The Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America is the name that it goes by here. And, you know, this is not ARP. This is the Reformed Presbyterian Church, which is much smaller. It's based in the north somewhere. I don't remember what. But you have the ARP, the Associate Reformed Presbyterian, which is based out of Erskine College in Due West, South Carolina. And it's a different group. Anyway, okay, back to the big church, the main Church of Scotland. The condition of the church at the beginning of the 19th century was a condition that was dead. Unfortunately, the orthodoxy was dead. Now, there were good men. Thomas Halliburton was one of them. Interesting, when I went to the website early this morning, I didn't have a picture of Halliburton, so I had in my notes, get one. And this morning I went to get it. And the website I went to get it from, the picture was there, but it said the website was closed today because it's closed on Sunday. The church was orthodox, but it was cold. Alexander White said that the Church of Scotland was sanctified by vinegar. Now, I like vinegar and barbecue, but vinegar and church members are not probably a really great description. Thomas Halliburton said that the men in the Church of Scotland had their hearts closed. They had the closed hearts, the message of free grace. Their hearts was closed, the condition of the lostness of all nations. The Church of Scotland at this time essentially opposed the missionary movement that was beginning, just as the high Calvinist had done in England. Well, into the Church of Scotland around this time, beginning of the 19th century, you have something called the Morrow Controversy. What in the world is the Morrow Controversy? The Ark Rater Presbytery, when men would come for ordination, asked them this question. Do you subscribe to the following? I believe that it is not sound and orthodox to teach that we must forsake sin in order to come to Christ. Not a trick question now. This is what they would ask their applicants for ordination. And they would ask them this not to trick them, but to expose something. What they were trying to expose was a subtle doctrine of preparationism that had entered into the church. You had to reform yourself. You had to do certain things before you could come to Christ. This presbytery recognized the problem with that, and they opposed it. And they attempted in every way they could to root it out of their men. A leading person who helped them was Thomas Boston. Thomas Boston was pastor in Ettrick, Scotland. Thomas Boston came upon a book. Well, yeah, that's things he wrote. He came upon a book called The Morrow of Modern Divinity, written by an Englishman, Edward Fisher. And this is where they came up with the Morrow men. These men who were asking this very penetrating question. The question is this: is there anything required before we come to Christ? Or is coming to Christ all that we need to do? Their answer would be, nothing is required but simply coming. But that begins a life of activity designed and devoted in some degree or another to seek and fellowship with Christ. You bring nothing and you're required to bring nothing, but when you come, it begins a real life in you. Another question, can we tell people this? Can we tell people that they can simply come to Christ? Or do we have to couch our words, shape and frame the message so that we don't preach it to the wrong person? This is the problem of hyper-Calvinism. You may preach the love of Christ to someone that Christ doesn't love, Dr. Packer says, you know, and holds his hands up when he's lecturing on the Puritans dealing with this thing. We need to, the moral man said, preach Christ to everybody because the Bible requires it and we should do it. Unfortunately, the Church of Scotland was in the hands of the moderates. The moderates could be epitomized by someone like the poet Robert Burns. Robert Burns says, "My creed is very nearly expressed by these words, 'Lord, grant that we lead a good life, for a good life makes a good end. At least it helps.'" That would be the profession probably of 95% of people in mainland churches today. Unfortunately, it's probably the profession of a lot of people in so-called evangelical churches today whose theology is so shallow and light that they don't know any more than this. Opposition to the moderates. John Witherspoon, who comes to America, it's interesting. Witherspoon writes, "Moderate preaching is like a winter's day, brief, cold, and dark." Love that quote. Brief, cold, and dark. Two great problems existed in the Church of Scotland. The problem of dead orthodoxy. Now, it wasn't non-orthodoxy. The men in the Church of Scotland still subscribed to the Westminster Confession of Faith. But it made no difference in their lives. It was dead orthodoxy. They claimed to believe it, but it really wasn't passionate. Another problem in the Church of Scotland was patronage. The landowners and much of Scotland was in the hands of the aristocrats. They owned large, large, massive tracts of land, and people worked on the land. The landowner had the final say in who the preacher at the church was going to be. In fact, he might have built the church. He paid the salary of the preacher, and so he had the final say. The landowner probably was not, in many cases, anxious to have an evangelical in the pulpit that was preaching about avarice, sin, and other things like that. It would make him very uncomfortable. People have said this thwarted the will of the people. From this, we began the period of the succeeders. When you think of the church in Scotland, you have to think of succeeders. Derek Thomas gave this. I ran this by Pastor Donnelly, and he agreed. Derek Thomas gave this little illustration when he started to speak at Ligonier. He said if you had four groups of men stranded on an island, two Welshmen, two Irishmen, two Scottish, and two Englishmen, within a year, the Welshmen would have formed a choral society. The Irish would have killed each other. The Scottish would have formed two Presbyterian churches, and the Englishmen would be waiting for someone to introduce them. Pastor Donnelly did not disagree with any of those. That's why I figured I could use it again. The Presbyterians in Scotland split more than the Baptists in the South. They succeeded. The succeeders succeeded from the succession. I can't keep up with it. I probably can't tell it, so I'll just list it real quick. To begin, the first actual succession was led by this gentleman, Ebenezer Erskine. Erskine said they formed in 1733 the Associate Presbytery. He says, "What difference does a piece of land make between man and man and the affairs of Christ's kingdom? Why should the Lord have any say in who comes to the church, that more say in who comes to the church than the servant who is in the church?" They formed three. There's now three churches in Scotland. You have the Church of Scotland, the Covenanter Church, and the Associate Presbytery. There were some who didn't think the Associate Presbytery went far enough, so they succeeded from it in 1761 and formed the Relief Presbytery. And then they're going to split some more. There are other denominations in Scotland, Scottish Episcopalians, Congregationalists, and Baptists. Believe it or not, we had some good Baptists. That's the picture of one, James Haldane, his brother Robert Haldane, wealthy men, evangelical, warm-hearted, went up to the Highlands to preach. The Church of Scotland said, "You can't be preaching, you're unauthorized." And they said, "But we're preaching the gospel." So they began to examine things. They left the Church of Scotland, became Baptist. These were wise men. Robert Haldane, who wrote Romans? Was it Robert? Robert did the commentary on Romans. Robert goes to Geneva, and the Lord uses him there. And I should have clicked my thing, and I would have known who wrote it, didn't I? There's the lives of the Robert and James reprinted by the banner that's available today. The commentary. Robert Haldane was used of the Lord for a revival in Geneva in the 1550s. Well, Roman Catholicism comes in to Glasgow because they needed workers. They got the Irish. The Roman Catholicism is probably the largest denomination in Scotland today. Renewal and division. Missions. Alexander Duff goes out under the Free Church. Robert Murray McShane is a minister in the Church of Scotland that we know as a warm, warm man, believing in missions abroad, holiness at home. Memoir of McShane is the greatest book of Scottish history, still being read by prophet today. Major divisions, there's 10 years of conflict. The disruption happens in 1743, the year of McShane's death. There were 400 ministers, 400 elders, and a third of the churches of the Church of Scotland pulled out and formed the Free Church of Scotland. Thomas Chalmers was one of the leaders of this. Chalmers was already a minister in the state church before he was converted. He was converted reading Pascal's Pensis and Wilberforce's Real Christianity. I am now most thoroughly convinced that in the system of do this and live, there is no peace. It is believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and thou shalt be saved. The Free Church of Scotland, other great men in it were William Cunningham, Rabbi John Duncan. A. Moody Stewart said of Duncan, "He was the only man I ever knew who appeared to believe and love every word of God without preferring one above another." In a banner article on Rabbi Duncan, there was this statement, "Every sin will be adequately punished. Blessed be God, not every sinner." Rabbi Duncan was a prolific in languages. He had a passion for the conversion of the Jewish people. Read his biography. Horatius Bonar, the songster or the singer of Scotland. We know the hymns of Bonar that we sing today. Evangelicals in Scotland today, you have a Free Church of Scotland. You have a continuing We Free Church of Scotland. Dr. Calhoun calls them the We Frees. There's a great story on the Isle of Stornoway. There's a church, a We Free Church, and there's 800 people in the morning, and there's 800 people in the evening. And you go there, and they all come in totally silent, sit there. They sing psalms without accompaniment. They have preaching. They go home. They come back at night. Dr. Calhoun says, as admirable as that is, and did I bring the quote? I hope so. Doesn't look like I did. Well, you'll have to believe me. He says, as admirable as that is, the church is making absolutely no impact on culture because it's not looking outside of itself. it worships together on the island of Stornoway. And they're very content to worship, and their worship is proper, and their worship is formal, and their preaching is warm. But their gospel is not warm, and their vision is for the Isle of Stornoway. And here's a Presbyterian saying, that's a problem. Church of Scotland, there are evangelicals today. William Still, Eric Alexander, Rutherford House, a place to study in Edinburgh. In fact, the movement of the Lord may be more in the Church of Scotland today with some evangelicals than it is in the Free Church or the We Free Church. I'm not one to comment on that. But I do know that there are evangelical schools in the Church of Scotland, like the Highlands Theological College in Inverness, where Nick Needham, who is pastor of Inverness Reformed Baptist Church, is professor of church history. We can pray for our brethren in Scotland. We can pray for our brethren in England. We can praise the Lord that He has His people in many places. Thank you. My apologies for running over.